God has really blessed me. You know, he let me work in D.C., let me work with EIB in Hollywood, in Silicon Valley. And he's shown me through all those experiences that there is one problem and one solution, and that's why we do this show.
Welcome to A Disciple's View with Todd Herman.
In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God, because we believe we speak. About happenings in this world, as we remain mindful that our true home is with Jesus Christ and His kingdom. I'm Todd Herman. Welcome to A Disciple's View. This past Monday, I had on my podcast Scott Shara, and I've told you about Scott and what happened to his daughter Grace, and you're going to hear Scott tell this story. They just lost a jury trial with some ridiculously offensive decisions from a judge that I think helped make this case something they lost. Scott Shara joined me via video, him from Wisconsin, me in my studio in North Idaho. You can watch this entire thing at my Substack site. It's thetoddhermanshow.substack.com, thetoddhermanshow.substack.com. We can't put the video on YouTube. YouTube would destroy our account for that. This is part one of my discussion with Scott Shara. So, Scott, you got removed from the hospital. You were your daughter's power of attorney, or one of them, and okay, so I'm going to just set the scene. You, Scott, guy who owned an accounting firm and sold that, a godly Christian man. I imagine you were throwing punches, tossing Molotov cocktails, etc., making wild threats. What did the jury actually hear about why you, her father, was taken out by an armed guard?
Yeah, they heard, not surprising, two completely opposite stories. So what happened was I got into quite a discussion, and there was a nurse, her name is Emily Fisher, and she was the overnight nurse on October 9th, and she, her and I definitely had personalities that did not jive, and that's okay. I mean, there's all kinds of different people, so I'm sure, you know, some of it's on me, some of it's on her, but ultimately I told her bluntly that Grace needs to be fed. And, you know, I explained this all to the jury. I said, Grace needs to be fed. And I said, I know how we can do it, because I watched the physical or the respiratory therapist come in every 4 hours or so. They remove the BiPAP mask. They swab Grace's mouth. They hook her up to a high flow cannula on low, and Grace is fine. So, I mean, that's all we have to do. We can feed Grace. And she said, well, the doctors are never going to allow that. And I said, I don't care what the doctors allow. I am in charge of Grace's care, not the doctors. And ultimately, that confrontation led her to discuss it with nurse Allison Barkholz. And Allison Barkholz came on the stand. So I'm going to just finish up what happened then. So I had, because of the confrontation with her, instead of arguing with her further, I just said, I would like to have a meeting with Dr. Beck, who was the attending physician, and unit supervisor. Well, that meeting never happened. Instead, nurse Allison Barkholz came in at 7 a.m. in the morning on October 10th with an armed guard and said, you need to leave the hospital immediately. I said, what's the reason? And she said, the last shifts of nurses don't want you in the room. You've been shutting off the alarms at night, and we suspect you have COVID. And of course, I defended one of those things. So the second one, you know, shutting off the alarms. I mean, the nurses trained me how to reset these alarms. And regarding COVID, I said, you know, Dr. Baum, who was the daytime hospitalist at the beginning, he's the one who told me I'm going to get COVID. You know, so that was a risk that I took by coming in the hospital. So anyway, so this whole argument is right in front of Grace with an armed guard there. So just process that in and of itself. Then she threatened that if I don't leave immediately, she's going to call the Appleton Police Department. I ended up calling my business attorney of 20 years, and his name is Tom. I said, Tom, this is what's going on. What do you recommend? And he suggested leaving peacefully. Well, ultimately, then she gets on the stand. Allison Barkholz gets on the stand, and she tells a story that the reason that she kicked me out is I was so severe with COVID I could hardly stand. She's holding my hands just to hold me up so that I could even talk with her. But then, you know, her true personality and the true reason came out on cross-examination, because one of our attorneys was cross-examining her pretty tough. And then she blurted out that, well, if somebody's an a**, we should be able to take them out of the hospital.
Okay.
So the jury heard all of that, Todd.
Yeah.
And I want to say maybe the most telling sign of where the jury was at is that they only deliberated for approximately maybe 45 minutes.
No.
Yeah. So that really showed me what's going on.
Yeah.
And you know, with all the evidence that we brought in,
I don't think
it was shocking.
I don't think the evidence to me is more disturbing than, as I recall, I've talked with you many times. At the point where they were issuing this third drug to Grace, which is very similar to what they would give an end-stage hospice patient, that cocktail drugs, as I recall, yes, you'd gotten a good news call, and Grace is doing a lot better. And I know the jury heard this, and I want to make sure this podcast and radio family hears this. So if I'm right on that, wasn't that about the time that they started to insert this deadly drug cocktail?
At 10:12 is when we had this phone call with the doctor that you're referencing. So this is Dr. Shokar. He was also a defendant in the lawsuit. And he called Cindy and I, asking us, which we were expecting the call because we had a call with him the day before, and he asked us what our decision was relative to a pre-authorization for a ventilator. And we told him we're not going to pre-authorize a ventilator. Then he switched gears and said, Grace had such a good day yesterday, we should work on nutrition. We need to get her out of bed, get her bowels moving, get her fed so that we can get her out of here in the next several days. And during that conversation, we approved a feeding tube. Then he switched gears one more time and said, if Grace took a turn for the worse and her heart stopped, would you want us to keep working on her over and over? And I said, what are you talking about? Grace is doing fine. And Cindy chimed in and said, well, we expect you to do the best. God will do the rest. We hung up the phone with him at 10:55. At 10:56, he entered an illegal do not resuscitate order. At 11:25, Nurse McGinnis gave Grace, now she's at max dose Precedex starting at 840, which is 1.4. This is the 40% higher dose than Grace had ever been on. So she started at max dose Precedex at 840. At 11:25, she gave her lorazepam. And the excuse for lorazepam is, well, we had to calm Grace down because of inserting the feeding tube at 11:34. Well, she was already on max dose Precedex. Why did you have to add lorazepam? Okay, so now just to keep going with the timestamps, so you were talking about this good news phone call with the doctor. Well, I'm just going to finish off the day so people really understand the gravity of what I'm talking about. So now Grace is knocked out. In fact, the nurse in the medical records at 4 p.m. said that there's no further intervention available. At 5 o'clock, she said Grace was somnolent. At 5:30, she said she was somnolent. At 5:46, she gave her another dose of lorazepam. At 5:49, another dose of lorazepam. And then at 6:15, they're already documented in the medical records at 6:09 that Grace had no blood pressure. And at 6:15, Dr. Shokar ordered morphine.
I mean, I'm so sorry, that's forgive me, this is my opinion, that's a kill shot.
Well, it obviously was a kill shot because Grace is no longer here. The jury saw all this. We put the timeline right up on, there's TV screens in the courtroom. So we put all of what I just said to you, we showed this all in a timeline to the jury.
So let's talk about the effects of this on this earth where you and I are visitors. We are part of the exiled elect. We serve Jesus Christ. This is not our home. It's a place we visit and we want to leave it a better place. One of the earthly aftermaths of this is, at least in the state of Wisconsin, correct me if I'm wrong, when you walk into a hospital, you give up your rights. You are owned by the hospital. Should they decide that you need a random amputation or something, this is just something you have to live with. If they decide to give you a drug that is clearly causing side effects, adverse events to you, and some of them life-threatening, it's okay to triple down on that. If a family member asks a question or has observed, hey, here's a way that we could help, you can remove them by armed guard. You can suspect someone has COVID with no signs of that. You can give someone a drug that is causing one adverse event, then you can polydrug them. Even when they are unawake, passed out, non-responsive, you can give them a drug because they need to calm down. With this is all going on, with low blood pressure or no blood pressure, you can then issue morphine, which is known to further reduce oxygen saturation and have respiratory harm. You can do all of that and then walk away scot-free. And this can happen to anybody. Is that right?
Yeah, I love the way you said scot-free. That's good.
Yeah.
Good play on,
right.
Good play on your gut.
Right.
Yeah. You know, Grace, I can still laugh because, you know, Grace had a sense of humor. I have a sense of humor too. And, you know, it is, it's good to laugh. So yes, you summarized exactly the situation. You summarized it perfectly. And I pray to God that anybody with ears to hear is absolutely scared to go into a hospital, because that is a proper fear, not a fear from Satan. That is a proper fear, which would cause you to change your belief, which causes you to change your actions. So once your belief changes, so we've all been programmed that hospitals are safe zones. Doctors follow the Hippocratic Oath, which, you know, sidebar, the Hippocratic Oath is not first do no harm like we've been programmed to believe. It is an oath to satanic gods. And so once your belief changes, you will have the ability to physically save yourself. Similarly to spiritually, once your belief changes that there's a God of the universe and he has a set of character traits that cause you to recognize, I cannot reconcile to him on my own, and that's why Jesus Christ came. Well, now your belief changes spiritually, and consequently your actions change. So that's what I'm hopeful that this case brought out. Ben, Grace's death was not in vain. Yeah. Ben.
You, Scott, you'd asked those of us who are following the trial to pray for the doctors and the nurses.
Yes.
And I do, because I think, and you know, I know I'm going to have a conversation with Jesus on Judgment Day. I know I'm saved. I know I'm accepted as my Lord and Savior. I know I've agreed to be changed by him. I do everything I can to abide with him. And you and I both know we all fall short, sometimes for full seasons, other times for days or moments. It says a lot about what Jesus has done in your heart that you that you're praying for them. And I would just ask you this. This is a tough question. Are you anxious to see Grace in heaven? I mean, you seem such a happy man and still have a mission to do here, but do you find yourself anxious to go to heaven, Scott?
Well, it's interesting. During the trial, very few people know this. I told my wife, I told my best friend. So about, I don't know how long ago it was, maybe once I realized, where I fit in the trial, you know, I needed to testify.
Yeah.
You know, the trial could not happen without my testimony. So I prayed to God. So this is maybe a year ago. I prayed that, keep me alive through the trial.
Okay.
And then the last, on Tuesday, so Tuesday of the last week, the trial was 2 weeks and 4 days. And Tuesday of that last week, I woke up with severe heartburn, thinking, and I was diagnosed with heart disease 7 years ago. So I thought, oh, this is really odd to wake up with this. In fact, it woke me up, and it went away about 7:30 that evening. I had another heart event at about 9:30, and I was with the legal team in the house that I rented for them. And they saw me turn gray and thought, you know, what's going on here? So I went home and I laid in bed that night. And I just said to God, I know I only prayed to stay alive through the trial. It's over. I mean, the testimony was over. And if this is my time, I'm content with it. And, you know, as he chose, I mean, I woke up the next morning and I'm here today. So I don't know what he has in mind here yet for me. I mean, I have in mind what my mission is, because my mission, this trial is just a small puzzle piece in the mission I was given. I was given a mission, Todd, to not use grace's story to expose evil. That's my mission. And that's what I've been working full time on for about 2 years. I took a 3 month time off for trial preparation, but that's what I'm going to keep going on. And so, you know, what do I mean by that? If you read Ephesians 5:11, it says, you have nothing to do with the fruitful deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Well, that's not what it says. It says that in your NIV Bible and the modern translation Bibles. But if you go back to the Bibles, the Geneva Bible, the Tyndale Bible from the 1500s, it says to rebuke evil, not expose it. So that's why God gave me that message. What happens is when we're exposing evil, not rebuking, but exposing it. The sky is falling. Look at all this evil. That fits into Satan's playbook. Esoterically, Satan has another role to play. He's got an evil role and a less evil role. The less evil role is the angel of light. And we always respond the same. Whenever there's fear and all this, the sky is falling, we always gravitate towards security and comfort, which is the angel of light strategy from Satan. This is a battle for souls.
Yeah.
And that is why I was called. I did not know any of this until after Grace's death, but God woke me up to it. And that's the single most important message I want to share to anybody listening.
I appreciate you sharing it with us, Scott. And thank you for welcoming us into this journey. My one regret here, I mean, obviously I regret what's happened to your daughter, but I regret I didn't get to meet her because something tells me I would have gotten a kick out of her. Continue here with part two of my discussion with my friend Scott Shara, who, as you're hearing, lost his daughter Grace to what I still contend was medical murder. And he's asked us to pray for the doctors and nurses, and let's do that together. We'll come back on the Disciples View. Welcome back to Disciples View. Coming up, we'll get to the Tower of Babbling and clean up item. Actually, a great email from someone who encountered an angel when he was in combat duty. And then, of course, we'll wrap up the show with a personal note. This is me discussing the Grace Shara case with Grace's dad, Scott. Grace, in my judgment, was medically murdered. You could watch this entire thing at my Substack site. It's thetoddhermanshow.substack.com. I cannot put this video on YouTube because YouTube would destroy my account. This is part two of me talking with Scott Shara. So you got this lawsuit, Scott, and that in and of itself was an act of God, I think, because it is not easy to be able to even get to court. And you had some statistics at one point about how rare it is to be able to get into court. Then I want to get into the courtroom, what happened there. But do you remember those statistics you shared with me and how rare it is to be even able to sue a medical company and system?
You have a 0.003% chance of getting to jury trial. And then once you get to, so that's a small subset.
Yeah.
So there's 27,000 medical malpractice incidences that are documented in Wisconsin annually. 84 have the chance to go to trial, which is the 0.003%. And then the chance of winning once you get to trial is only 3% of that. So it's extremely rare to get to trial. It's even rarer to win. And, that's okay. I mean, we were called to do this trial. God called us into it. If you just process this, Todd, from, zoom out. You mentioned about the medical industrial complex just now. Well, the medical industrial complex, to be blunt, is anybody that accepts Medicare and Medicaid is bought. So if you're going to take care of your own health, there are individual doctors, nurses, naturopaths, chiropractors that do not accept Medicare and Medicaid. And you have to have a relationship with one of those people to not be in the system. Well, the legal system is in bed with that system. So process the idea that if we would have, so losing was really expected if you think about it. Why? Because that's the system. The system is designed that way. Well, let's just take the opposite. Let's say that we would have won. Okay, if we would have won, that would have been a less evil victory. So I'm in, you know, the paradigm of evil versus less evil is played out in Revelation 13. God explains Satan's dualistic nature. He's got an evil nature and a less evil nature. So if we would have won, people would have been cheering and, oh gosh, you know, they would have thought the system was good. Well, no, it would have been a victory in spite of the system. I'm not seeing it from the point of view that I'm, you know, I'm distraught because we lost. No, I mean, it would have been, it's a miracle regardless of winning or losing that we got this far in the Antichrist legal system. And it's out there for the public to review now at any time.
Yep, yep. And let's run through some things that, to me, show how captured the system is. The jury heard you testify, I assume, and they heard you and your lawyers state that you, Scott, only signed off on one course of treatment, oxygen and steroids, and everything thereafter was the establishment. So they heard that.
Well, not they didn't just hear it, they saw it. And it, you know, amazingly, the judge ruled that because we were in the hospital, we consented to everything. You give them an implicit consent just by being in the hospital. That should scare anybody. And I'm going to be very specific on that in a minute. But what do I mean by they saw it? So they heard me say it, but then they actually saw it, Todd. We showed in the medical records that the general consent form that they want you to sign when you get into the hospital was never signed. In fact, what they did, you can see they did it after the fact. So this Grace and I were in the emergency room about 15 minutes, and this document has that timestamp. It says that Grace orally approved a general consent at 2:27 in the afternoon on October 6th. But we were only in the emergency room for 15 minutes. I was with Grace. So how did they get her oral consent for this document? You know, it makes no sense. Grace had Down syndrome. She's not going to give an oral consent. And the power of attorney and her dad and her advocate are right in the room. So, I mean, it's completely ridiculous. So there was no general consent. And regardless, even if I would have signed a general consent, that doesn't mean I'm signing my rights away. But that's what the judge ruled, is that you basically are signing your rights away. And I'll be very specific, as I said I would be. That relative to the most egregious, you know, the med combination is egregious, obviously, but the illegal DNR is what should really scare people. And ultimately, the judge ruled and the jury decided, well, the judge said this implicit with the implied consent idea. But then the jury basically ruled because, and I say basically because they did not believe a DNR needed to be executed. The defense had two experts in that said that a DNR can be unilaterally placed on a patient without consent, without a witness, without a signature, and without a bracelet. So that's what the testimony from the defense was, and the jury sided in favor of the defense. We only had one juror that sided in favor of us, which represents 8%, which I believe that's representative of the population that gets what I even talk about. Most of them have been programmed. If you think about the programming, if the average age of the juror was 50 years old, that means they've had 50 years of programming. So, you know, all the testimony, I mean, we had a better case, better witnesses, better preparation, better experts. Everything was in our favor. In fact, we thought even the worst days that we had, we still thought we won the day. You know, as I sat down with the legal team after each day, and yet we lost to the jury. So it's shocking, but it's not shocking at the same time.
Yeah, and understand that formulation. And so let me play this out. The judge's decision on what you'd agreed to and not agreed to, they're effectively lying, and I trust you that they lied. I don't have any doubt that they lied. And this was the judge who boxed the jury in on this way?
Well, the judge, because they dismissed the battery claim before the case went to the jury. So the battery claim was exactly about what you're explaining. And when I testified, it was, you know, so it wasn't a leg amputation. But sure. Interestingly, I used that example that you just said, and I'll explain, because they kept presenting that I would not agree to a ventilator. So we were never asked to put Grace on a ventilator, less one time on the 8th, which you know, she ended up not needing the ventilator then based on a retest. So they kept asking us for a pre-authorization for a ventilator, which we know why now, because of the incentives during COVID for ventilators.
Yes.
But ultimately, they were always asking for a pre-authorization. So the question never came up, or the challenge never came up to say, listen, Grace has to be on a ventilator, or she's going to die. Will you approve that? That question was never posed. And so when I was on the stand, I explained that for me to pre-authorize a ventilator would be like me going in for an ankle sprain and pre-authorizing a leg amputation, right? I mean, why would I pre-authorize a ventilator just right. because Grace is in the hospital? That would make no sense. And so I was not pre-authorizing that. I explained that to the jury when I was on the stand, but yeah, ultimately, you know, it's hard for me to grasp because we had such a clear case, but yet not believable by the jury.
So Scott, the jury was also availed of the fact, and this, to me, this is utterly mind-blowing, that the drugs they gave her, every one of these drugs has the effect of lowering oxygen levels, right? Oxygen absorption in the body, oxygen saturation. And every one of these drugs was presented as necessary by the defense, but did they offer any evidence that Grace was in pain or afraid or resisting, or what possible evidence did they have for giving your daughter Precedex and morphine and this other drug?
So Precedex, we were able to get the Precedex package insert in at trial. And we showed the jury this. So there were 12 side effects on the package insert that Grace had. Okay, this is what she had as side effects that are listed in the package insert. Respiratory depression, hypoxia, agitation, acidosis, hypotension, fever, blood pressure fluctuation, anxiety, delirium, sepsis, acute respiratory distress syndrome, and cardiac arrest. Okay, so those are all side effects of Precedex.
Oh.
Okay. And so Grace had these, but they ignored them. They said that, you know, and I'm going to zoom out to the ICU here for a minute. When Grace went into the hospital, she was in room 2029. She also died in room 2029. When a patient is put on Precedex, which they started Grace on Precedex at 10 p.m., on October 7th, she had already been in the room for 22 hours. Well, the first 22 hours, she was not in ICU. I find out after I got the invoice that I saw the charge, the room charge change to regular room to ICU. I didn't even know she was in ICU because it was in the same room. And so then once they're in the ICU, they use this as the excuse in the trial. The defense said, well, these are common drugs in the ICU. She's in the ICU, and that's how they monitor the patient. So they're there monitoring. And, well, they monitor based on their blinders. They don't monitor. They don't realize that if somebody has side effects, they should be taken off that drug. Our attorneys brought up, they just posed this question to one of the defense experts, and the defense expert had to agree with us. And the question was, if your son or daughter had a side effect, a reaction to aspirin, so they have a first reaction to aspirin, would you give them a second one? So then now, let's say that you did, and now they had a second reaction to the same aspirin, would you do it a third time? And that's what happened to Grace. I mean, she had two reactions. The first one wasn't life-threatening on October 7th. The second one on October 8th was actually life-threatening. They saved her life with resuscitation drugs, but then they did it a third time.
Did they have any cogent reason for why they introduced Precedex to your daughter?
Well, they explained that she was agitated. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, so the way I look at that, you know, Grace was agitated a few times, and they're easily documented. The first time that they did Precedex, she actually was legitimately agitated. And I explained this to the jury also. She was agitated because they had put her on a high-flow cannula without me even knowing it.
What's that?
You know, because a high-flow, it's called a Vapotherm, and so it looks just like a regular cannula, but they hook up a machine to it. And, you know, it's interesting because—
But people don't know what a cannula is.
Okay, so a cannula is the the two prongs
okay,
that are
go
in
up your nose.
Your nose. And then, you
okay.
know, they wrap it around your ear, and then it's hooked to an oxygen tank. Okay, in the hospital, it's hooked to, you know, wall oxygen. Well, they had, in line with that cannula, they hooked up a high flow device, so they made it go faster up Grace's nose. Well, they turned that high flow device up to, and even the nurse said it was going up Grace's nose at 40 miles an hour. So that agitated her. So, you know, instead of just saying, oh, yeah, that's agitating her, let's get her back on a regular cannula, because she wasn't agitated at all, they gave her Precedex. Okay. So she was legitimately agitated then. There was another time she was legitimately agitated. Well, although we weren't there. This was after I was taken out by an armed guard. Our daughter Jessica was in the room. And when she was made to go home to take a shower. That's another strange situation in this case. Because they told her that you can't take a shower in the room because you're going to aerosol the virus. I mean, what a crazy thought process. But Jessica went home to take a shower while she's... While she's at home for that hour and a half, they strap Grace down to the bed because she wanted to get out of the bed and poop. And so, of course, now she's agitated because they strapped her down. And then the third time she was agitated is when they inserted a feeding tube. So, I mean, these are all times that any of us would have been agitated, right? So I look at it through the lens, you know, so you're in the hospital. You're bought by the medical industrial establishment. You're a nurse. And I've seen this. I mean, I've seen it in some of the nurses' training. Even their coffee mugs and things will have versions of this on that. You know, a sedated patient is a good patient. You know, that's the view of the world that they have because it makes their job easier.
That was Scott Shara, my friends. He's lost his daughter, but you can see he's not lost his faith. Praise God. We'll come back with a personal note and the tire babbling. I'm Todd Herman. This is The Disciples View. Welcome back to Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. We'll get to the tire babbling here in a personal note in just a second. First, an email, and this is pretty chilling and pretty faith-affirming. James writes, "Dear Todd, I had a direct encounter with an angel in Fallujah, Iraq in 2004. It's a longer story. I'd be willing to tell you or send you a story via email if you like, and I will follow up with James and get that." James continues, "Short version is in a close quarters urban environment. We entered a house with nine armed terrorists, and an angel caused me to go into a room. The angel kneed me in my rear end as a one man in our clearing team, and I was alone. The kneeing made me think my team initiated the standard operating procedure to enter the room and to begin to clear it. I cleared it alone, unknowingly alone. I thought my team need me because it launched me into the doorway. It was such a hard knee. A long wall left me in the center of the room, and I found myself alone with nine terrorists. I blinded them the best I could with my surefire light and screamed for my team to hurry over. They eventually got there and saw what had happened. We later found out that the place I stopped my clearing pattern had left me in the perfect middle between the enemy and their weapons. God saved us and the lives of those terrorists. They were unable to hear us beating the front door in or clearing in the very next room. That is physically impossible. There's absolutely no logical way they could have failed to have heard us. So let me summarize this, Todd. Somehow the terrorists were deafened. Somehow, and I think by the power of God, they were unable to know we were there and making it possible for us to live and not get massacred by them and not massacre them either. Who kneed me in my rear end so hard that it launched me into the room head first? If my team was on the other side of the house, who did that? Obviously, an angel of the Lord did it to protect us. Later that day, another miracle occurred. I miraculously took three bullets to my leg, but somehow they didn't hurt me. They went in and out of my uniform.
I saw multiple other miracles in combat, but that's just two. Save more for a later day and about another firefight. James, number one, welcome home. Thank you. Thank you for doing what most of us could not. And thank you for living through it. And my heart grieves for the brothers you lost over there, because you undoubtedly lost some. And my heart sings that it seems you're protected by God in those circumstances. And I'd love for you one day, James, to meet my friend Tim Cruikshank. Tim is a retired Navy SEAL. He runs a coffee company called Bone Frog Coffee, and had been a SEAL team instructor, or a buds instructor, I should say. And he once had to parachute in to Babylon, literally fighting a war, a biblical scope, in one of the most infamous areas of the Bible, Babylon. I think you and he would be quick friends, fast friends, I should say. And I'll share with you something Tim told me about how he, a very, very soft-spoken SEAL, how he actually was a buds instructor and a guy who never yelled, never screamed, never did what SEAL or buds instructors are pretty famous for doing. It's a pretty interesting take on keeping guys in the team who should be there and weeding out guys who should not be. On this program, we've made it a habit to thank our Lord, Jesus Christ, for placing supposedly wise people on tall towers of shaking sand. We see them all the time in so-called public service. And we do this in a feature called The Tower of Babbling.
You know about the biblical truth of the Tower of Babel. A Disciple's View presents...
America is a nation that can be defined in a single word. I was going to put him...
The Tower of Babbling.
Three sound bites in today's Tower of Babbling. That's almost always the case. Jonathan Capehart. Interestingly, I have to give him a little credit. Earlier this week, Jonathan Capehart actually admitted that the launch of the missiles, the bunker busters into Iran, was a brilliant strategic and tactical success. He actually did that, so I should be fair. But this is what we commonly get from Jonathan Capehart. The GOP is afraid of something, says Jonathan Capehart of PBS.
Republicans have learned that when they fall out of line with the president, when they criticize the president, whether it's on rhetoric or anything else, that they're going to get punished for it.
That's actually quite frightening, which I think explains why there's been silence, crickets, because they're afraid of doing the right thing, of being human, will get them on the wrong side of the president of the United States. Folks should be very concerned about that.
Being human. Like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who just put out a very, very lengthy statement stating that she supports the president in most of his agenda, that she agrees he's making America great again, but she will not vote for or support interventionist wars on behalf of the United States, or the globalist, if you like. J.D. Vance, apparently behind the scenes, argued that America should not be fighting this particular war for Israel. President Trump has hired into his cabinet people who ran against him. Marco Rubio called him names, pretty severe names, and Marco Rubio is his Secretary of State. He surrounded himself with people like Tulsi Gabbard, who called him names and said he was a great danger to the country. President Trump is apparently okay with people being human. While he is president and they're on his team, he would like them to speak with one voice. What a weird thing for a president to want. Next soundbite in today's Tower Babbling. This was an MSNBC panel reaction to states that will not allow so-called gender-affirming drugs for kids.
I think this is a sign by the court that the six conservative justices are just not going to stand in the way of these, I think, quite bigoted and openly transphobic laws that are designed to prevent trans people from living and flourishing in this country.
So the design is to stop people who think they're the opposite sex from living and flourishing. They think they're the opposite sex, even though their bodies show otherwise. And they tell us all the time that our genitalia is not connected to our sex. Our genitalia is meaningless. So
we get to force you to mutilate our genitalia. It all falls apart, every bit of it. If you can be a woman and have male parts, you can thrive as a woman with male parts. You don't need to force us to change your bodies. And for kids, kids who at the age of 10 or 11, almost all of them think they're going to be rap stars or rock stars or sports stars. And they find out later that they ain't going to be. That's not causing them to be unable to thrive. It's having them wait to make life-changing, life-altering, body-altering, brain chemistry-altering decisions for the rest of their lives. Last soundbite in today's Tower Babbling, also from MSNBC. They had the founder of the Trevor Project on to discuss the Trump administration's recent removal of LGB so-called TQ youth options from the suicide prevention hotline.
When a veteran calls their specialized hotline, they need to speak to someone who understands military stress. They need to
PTSD.
PTSD, family separation, combat stress. When an LGBTQ plus youth calls the line, they need someone who understands LGBTQ plus youth stress and trauma, such as family rejection, homelessness. That is exactly why we had these specified lines with tailored interventions created, because tailored interventions actually increase their survival rate.
No, they don't. Because a tailored intervention where someone is calling a helpline saying, I'm a boy trapped in a girl's body, so I'm going to kill myself. When the first response from the so-called therapist is, yes, you are a boy trapped in a girl's body. It is adding to the lies. It is cementing the position. It is putting child against family. And that belief that your body is a lie, that doesn't go away for most people after the gender mutilations, surgical and chemical. That's one of the chief reasons they remain high risk for suicide. A decent therapist could listen, can say that sounds very painful. That must be a horribly confusing. I admire the fact that you've called. You've made a wise decision that shows me that there's a good brain in there. A good therapist does not ever affirm a psychosis. And that's a wrap for today's Tower of Babbling.
That was the Tower of Babbling.
Everybody knows I like kids better than people.
On a Disciple's View.
On a personal note today, I was sharing the note from James, who served in our military, wrote to us that he encountered an angel in Fallujah in 2004. And it just brought to my mind my friend Tim Cruikshank, who was a SEAL. He was a medic attached to the SEAL teams. And I know it's corpsman. Tim chooses to say medics, so that's what I'll do. And when he came back, he founded this coffee company, Bone Frog Coffee. And he was also, prior to that, a buds instructor. And I got to know Tim through the coffee company. And full disclosure, he's a partner of my podcast. So after getting to know him, I noticed something. I've been blessed to know a couple of SEALs. And then I went to the SEAL Fit program and was trained by real live SEALs. And they are not shy people, most part. And the SEALs who trained us, their job was shock and awe. For the first part of that SEAL Fit, their job was shock and awe, and it worked particularly well with me. I embarrassed myself. And praise God for my teammates who helped me come out of that. And for Coach Mel, who forced me out of it. God bless Coach Mel. Great, great lady. And a Marine, by the way. So I observed the yelling and the screaming. If you've seen the shows, you've seen the intimidation and the mocking, and it's all purposeful. It's all designed to wash the weak ones out because you don't want weak people on your team, and you don't want them getting killed or getting others killed. When I got to know Tim, I noticed that he was so soft-spoken. He still is. He's a very gentle gentleman. I mean, he's tall, and he is, he's not physically imposing until you shoot with him or you see him move. And he's regaining his health. He went through a really tough stretch with his wife, and he just spent all waking hours just saving Liz's life for 20 years. He extended her life for 20 years as she fought cancer. Just such a brilliant, brilliant man. He's a medic. He was a physician's assistant in the real world. So I've seen Tim become SEAL Tim twice. And it was when he was telling stories. And he doesn't tell war stories. But he was talking about a bag of coffee they designed that honored a particular warrior, and he told me what this warrior had done. And I saw Tim change. And he was talking about this battle this guy was in, and this guy who had a broken femur, but somehow was able to sit up on a knee and defend himself against a couple hundred Taliban coming at him in the desert while they were trying to land their helicopter that had been hit with an RPG. And he changed. He changed. It was chilling. And that was a guy who knows how to kill people and break things. But overall, he's a very, very soft-spoken dude. So one day we were talking, walking around, and I said, hey, I got to ask you a question. You are so soft-spoken, and God has made you so humble and so kind. How did you ever, when you were a Buds instructor, how did you ever yell at people and belittle them and intimidate them? He said, oh, Todd, I never did that. I never did that. He said, no. My technique was to come up and jog next to you after you'd had a big failure. Say you screwed up an evolution or you cost your team a position. So 4 o'clock in the morning, whenever, on a long rock, I would jog up next to you and say very, very quietly, hey, listen, I've really gotten to like you while you've been here. And I've done this a bit. You know, I was a SEAL and I'm a Buds instructor. And I can tell you, you're not going to make it. Like, you're going to wash out. So instead of having some big defeat and seeing everybody watch that, why don't you just peel off with me? And I'll just take you up real quietly. I mean, you have to ring out, but we'll do it real quietly. And then just go pop in the hot tub and I'll bring you some coffee and some donuts. And but come and try next year. You'll come more prepared. I bet you can make it next year, but you're not going to make it this year. I said to Tim, does that work? He said, yes, sadly it does. He said, but if you can be sweet-talked out of the teams, sweet-talked off the battlefield, you're not someone I could have on my six. And it did work. And occasionally the guys did come back. And they did come back stronger. And they came back with a bigger why. See, this is a big thing in SEALFIT, your why. You have to have a huge why to go through something like that. Now, we all go through seasons, storms. Jesus said, do not be surprised when you have troubles in this life. What is your why? What's the big why? Why do you keep going? May I suggest one? Because Jesus did. He could have packed it in. He could have sweet-talked himself away from the cross. He is, was, and always will be God. He could have called the legions of angels, but instead, he fulfilled the law. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Because we believe, we speak. Because he first loved us, we speak his word. We walk in the path of Jesus Christ and make disciples of all nations. Until God joins us together again, may his peace wash over you. On behalf of Randy and AFR, I'm Todd Herman, and this has been The Disciples View.